before Dr. Ruth, before Dr. Laura, even before Ann Landers, there was C. Israel Lutsky. Starting in 1933, 5 days a week, for more than 30 years, Lutsky read letters and dispensed guidance to his Jewish immigrant audience. He called himself and his program Der Yiddischer Philosoph, the Jewish philosopher, although his credentials weren't quite as impressive as the title suggested. Before crowning himself the Jewish philosopher, Lutsky was a vaudeville comedian, a soapbox socialist, and an amateur boxer. Still, despite his dubious qualifications and what can charitably be described as an abrasive on-air presence, the Jewish philosopher became one of the best-known and most beloved figures in the history of Yiddish radio. Our story is told by the philosopher's longtime English language announcer, Dick Sugar.
This is Dick Sugar, and I worked on the Yiddische Philosoph, the Jewish philosopher, from 1946 to 1957 on radio station WEVD. No recordings of the shows that I announced on exist, but I have no problem remembering how that introduction used to go. Ladies and gentlemen, time once again to join radio's most interesting Jewish personality, the Jewish philosopher.
Gott helfach, meine liebe Freund.
C. Israel Lutsky, a red-faced little man with one of the biggest egos I've encountered in my 56 years in radio. Every weekday at 2 p.m., Lutsky would go on the air to read questions from his listeners. I'd watch through the control room window as he'd work himself up into a frenzy, waving his arms and spitting and berating his audience. A half century ago, you just didn't yell on the radio like that. But the more he lambasted his audience, the more they seemed to love him. Let's listen now to the Yiddish philosoph in action. Karl Reiner is the English voice of C. Israel Lutsky.
God help you, my dear friends. My dear friends, I have here a letter from a listener whose initials are NG, and she writes thus. My son, friend philosopher, who is 36 years old, was left a widower 3 years ago with a young child of 5 years. Last year, he married an old maid who's about a year younger than him, and it seems to me that he has not made a very smart move. Firstly, she knows nothing about how to prepare a good meal. Furthermore, when she comes to visit, she always holds his hand from the minute they both sit down until the minute they go home. Truth to be told, my son doesn't look so bad that I can complain that she doesn't cook as well as me or his first wife. No, my husband says not to mix in so much. But what does he know about what a real mother feels who wants to see her son only happy and content? I beg you then, my heartfelt friend philosopher, tell me if I am acting like a bad mother-in-law or a good, true mother. I remain your longtime listener, Mrs. N.G.
Mrs. N.G.
My dear Mrs. N.G., I can glean from your brief little letter whether you're indeed a good mother or a bad mother-in-law. But one thing is positively clear, that you lack common sense. My answer to you is found in those four English words.
Mind your own business.
Which is the same thing your husband said to you in a more gingerly delicate way. Considering that you won't listen to your own husband's advice, how can I, a stranger, hope that you would take my advice? As I said earlier, it's hard for me to figure out whether you are a good mother or a lousy mother-in-law. But one thing is not hard to see. You are, in fact, a foolish Jewish woman.
The Jewish philosopher's sponsor was Carnation Milk. Lutsky was fanatical about the product. He always kept a white carnation pinned to his lapel and would spend his vacations visiting carnation canneries across the country, traipsing around like a king. His approach to the commercials, well, sometimes it seemed like only Lutsky himself understood what he was talking about.
My dears, you probably heard the story of a young man who wanted everything, hmm? I mean, when it came to wanting, he knew how to want, but when it came to doing, nothing doing. I know dozens of young men like this, and probably so do you. People who want everything, but just can't take it. There's a term for this in English that sums it up, and this little word is
allergic.
So if you catch my drift, this one is allergic to boiled onions, this one is allergic to calf's foot jelly, and a third, and there are thousands of these number threes, a third can't handle milk. This is really a rotten deal. Everybody big and small alike needs milk, but there are small children and adults too, thousands of them, who simply cannot tolerate it. And if they force themselves to drink a glass when it's absolutely necessary, it's like driving a corkscrew into their guts. But science comes forward and helps such people. How? By inventing the miracle of carnation milk. People with allergies find that this milk goes down smooth and easy, without any grief. Not always it's true, but in a considerable number of these allergy cases, carnation milk comes to the rescue, just like the hero in an old-fashioned melodrama. New allergic schmergic, what's it to me? If you want the very tastiest, the very best, the most dependable and digestible and nutritious form of milk, do as I tell you and buy and use wonderful Carnation milk, the milk recommended to you over and over again by your friend, the Yiddish philosopher.
Der Yiddisher Philosoph.
Israel Lutsky was also a shameless self-promoter. In November 1937, he actually put out a magazine dedicated to himself. Only one issue was ever published.
This publication is founded around a forceful and magnetic personality, the most outstanding and most widely known Jewish radio oracle. It even bears the same name, his name, which he has made a household term in every Jewish household. The Jewish philosopher has stayed the hands of self-executioners.
Despite his self-indulgent streak, Lutsky remains one of the most vividly remembered and best adored characters from the golden age of Yiddish radio. He never shied away from difficult topics and often addressed issues you wouldn't hear anywhere else on the air. Let's take a few moments and listen to this letter from a Holocaust survivor, broadcast at a time when most people didn't want to talk about, hear about, or even think about what happened to the Jews of Europe.
I'm sure, dear people, that no introduction is needed for this letter which I now hold in my hand. Dear friend philosopher opens the letter. I have wanted to send this to you many times, but I kept putting it off. I'm a newly arrived immigrant. I'm 30 years old and survived the hellish suffering of the Hitler years in Europe. I lost my father, my mother, three brothers and their wives and children, and two sisters and their in-laws. I lost all my uncles, aunts, and every other close relative, who, altogether, total a family of over 50 people who I loved and knew intimately. I really don't know if I consider myself lucky or unlucky that I was the only one to survive in the entire family. One alone on God's green earth. For my life, I paid a very dear price. I was dragged through six different concentration camps, and several times I stood poised to be sent to the gas chambers. After the war, I decided I couldn't remain in Poland, so I waited just like all the others waited, and many still wait, so I can come to America. From the first minute I arrived, I was in love with America. I loved everything I saw, and the feeling overwhelmed me so that I kissed the earth. But I have no one to tell my problems. I have a mark, friend philosopher. I have a brand, and this is seared in my flesh.
Number.
A number.
Of the linker hand.
Of my left arm.
The number.
The number. Of the ghastly death camp.
Auschwitz.
Auschwitz. In winter, no one sees the number. I wear a dress with long sleeves, sometimes a sweater, sometimes a coat. But when it's summertime in the New York heat, I have to wear a sleeveless dress. So here begins the hundreds of questions. Where does it come from? How did it happen? To my great disappointment, I found that the vast majority of people interested in the number see it on my left arm had no inkling of what this was. They never heard of the camps or the gas chambers, or that they burn numbers into the arms. These are Jews I'm speaking of, and some even thought that maybe I had tattooed a number on myself like a sailor tattoos flowers or pictures of their wife on their arms. They did not know that this number was tattooed with an indelible ink which cannot be washed out, and that the number 81,568 illustrates that I was the 81,568 one at Auschwitz. About that, they don't know. When it's winter, I feel lucky. No questions and no painful answers. Now, dear friend philosopher, summer is coming and I am enveloped in fear. What should I do? How should I hide myself to avoid these stupid questions? I beg you to help me. Your devoted listener, Mrs. M.G.
Mrs. Mam Gimel.
My very dear friend, Mrs. M.G., I have to tell you that your letter really upset me. I am ashamed that among our Jews, one can still find people who do not know what happened in the camps. But I would like to know, what kind of places do you go to meet such people who don't know what happened to the Jews of Europe? I have to say here, my beloved Mrs. M.G., that I have to defend the lion's share of American Jews, because we American Jews know everything. Jews in America know everything. It cannot be true what you say about American Jews. Among Jewish Jews, you'll find that people do indeed know about your suffering and pain. Possibly those people you meet at the beach somewhere by the seaside. I don't know what kind of people they are. But you can't convince me that the Jews don't know. We know about the tragic chapter in our Jewish history.
And so, another episode of the Jewish Philosopher Program would come to an end. In apartments and stores all over New York, listeners would pause, let the word sink in, and then go back to whatever they were doing before the broadcast started. In our studio, C. Israel Lutsky would wipe the steam off his glasses, slap his papers together, stick his cigar back in his mouth, and strut out into the hallway. The engineer would open up my mic and I'd say, The Jewish Philosopher is presented over station WEVD Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Tune in again tomorrow afternoon and every afternoon Monday through Friday when the Carnation Company will again bring you your friend and advisor, the Jewish Philosopher. This is Dick Sugar bidding you a pleasant day.
Here's the story that everyone knows.
Lucky Lindy, up in the sky, fair or windy, he's flying high. Fearless, knows every cloud. The kind of a sun makes a mother feel proud.
1927. Charles A. Lindbergh lifts off in his fragile one-seat plane from a runway in New York. 33 hours later, he touches down in Paris. His voyage was the first ever non-stop solo transatlantic flight. Lindbergh instantly becomes a worldwide hero, an icon, welcomed home by millions of ecstatic Americans and by his president, Calvin Coolidge.
This earnest, courageous product of America, driven by the spirit of his Viking ancestors, traveled 3,600 miles and established a new record. And as President of the United States, I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
But here's another story. This one is also about a man who crossed the Atlantic by plane in 1927, just 2 weeks later. But he wasn't tall, he wasn't blonde, and he wasn't Charles A. Lindbergh. No, he was Charles A. Levine, the first air passenger to cross the Atlantic. Passenger, you ask? So what? Well, to Jewish immigrants in America at the time, Levine's accomplishment was nothing short of miraculous, celebrated in song and story, retold again and again on Yiddish radio. The forgotten tale of Levine's spectacular rise and the unknown account of his terrible fall are brought to us now by Henry Sapoznik.
Charles A. Levine was born in 1897, and as a little kid was obsessed with flying. By the time he was in his 20s, he'd become a self-made millionaire in the junk business and decided to use his fortune to enter the race to be the first to fly across the Atlantic.
Levine, Levine, bis der Held jetzt finish rule. Levine, Levine.
Levine went out and bought the finest plane of his day and hired a pilot named Clarence Chamberlain to fly it for him. But 2 weeks before they were able to get off the ground, they lost the race. Lindbergh beat them across the Atlantic. Lindbergh has won the race and is a worldwide hero. But Levine decides to fly anyway. And he decides that he needs a gimmick. So he announces that there's going to be a mystery passenger, and no one knows who it's going to be. Clarence Chamberlain is the pilot, but who is the mystery passenger? The plane is on the runway. Propellers are turning, the plane is warming up. While everyone waits for this supposed mystery passenger to turn up, Levine tells his wife, "Oh, I'm just going to get into the plane for a moment, and we're just going to taxi around the airfield." It wasn't until the plane took off and was heading out over the trees out into the open ocean that everyone realizes that it was Levine all along who was the mystery passenger. His wife sees this, she faints dead away. His kids see it, they burst into tears. And meanwhile, Levine is on his way.
Hey, Levine, Levine, mit Chamberlain geflogen.
This is a recording of Levine der große Mann, Levine the big man. His wife and children knew nothing of his notion to fly across the ocean when he climbed into the plane. So Chamberlain and Levine actually make it. They beat Lindbergh's speed and distance record and nearly make it all the way to Berlin. The American public is interested in them for a day or two, and then Levine and Chamberlain fade from the headlines. But for the Jews, this was a big deal.
Der Tag.
The Day newspaper, June 7th, 1927. Clarence D. Chamberlain and Charles A. Levine have done it. Two. Chamberlain and Levine have set a new record in non-stop air travel. A new record of Jewish bravery, courage, and fortitude. Together with the American Christian Chamberlain, the American Jew Levine has broken the record for air flight. Charles A. Levine has created a new high point in the history of the Jews.
A neuem Rundfunk Yiddishen Rekord.
Jewish composers write song after song celebrating Levine.
Oi, flee, 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 Levine, of God bruch in thy machine.
The Jewish community goes absolutely crazy. They have a hero. Levine is all over the radio dial. This is the only known recording of his voice that survives.
My happiness is complete, though I never dreamt of the joy and thrill it would bring to so many others. Such feeling is the crowning jewel of our achievement.
This was an era when Jews would change their names. I mean, every one of the popular Jewish entertainers had changed their names. Eddie Cantor was Isidore Itzkowitz, Al Jolson was Asa Yoelson, Fanny Bryce was Fanny Borach. All these people changed their names to become part of American culture. Levine didn't change his name. So the Jewish community, the symbol of him not changing his name was really important.
Levine, Levine, you're the hero of your race. Levine, Levine, you're the greatest Hebrew ace. We got a thrill when Chamberlain flew, but you were right there too. We're proud of you, Levine. Levine, just an ordinary name, but you brought it everlasting fame.
But after a while, even the Jewish community forgot about Levine. He just disappeared off the radar screen. And that's the last the world heard of Charles A. Levine.
My name is Artith Polly. I'm the daughter of Charles A. Levine. My father just felt that he was going to make it. And I don't know whether it was stupidity or just confidence, but he made it. He became a hero of the air. And yeah, it was a dream, but I think it turned into a nightmare. It all happened, you know, after the flight, when he became this very famous, rich millionaire, young millionaire, and was sought after by all these women that were seeking notoriety as well as him. There was women that were chasing after him to get press, and some newspapers started to report about seeing here with this one and seeing here with that one, and giving diamond bracelets, which was his habit, to my mother. She'd pick up a napkin and there would be a diamond bracelet. Then she heard about him giving diamond bracelets to someone else. And so they were divorced. Although he begged and pleaded and said he was sorry and he'll kill himself and everything else, she got a divorce. And after that, he just went down rather than up. He lost a lot of money and was not the same Charlie Levine that he had been. I didn't know that much about him. I just knew he was my father and that he flew the Atlantic and that was it. Sometime after the divorce, he eventually moved in with my mother's friend. Her mother had an annuity that gave her so much a month, and my father lived off that and kept wheeling and dealing and nothing ever happened. So finally she ran. She picked herself up and she ran. And without her money coming in, he was destitute. He just went down, you know, to the depths that no one wants to wind up in. He was thrown out on the street. He was just wandering the streets, you know, if it wasn't for this nice woman who picked him up, you know, while he was wandering around. And he happened to mention that he was Charlie Levine, the first passenger to fly. Anyway, she took him in under her wing. My father must have gotten into trouble, a lot of trouble, because the FBI was looking for him. I was newlywed at the time. And I don't know how they found me, but they found me, and they were looking for my father, and I didn't know where he was. I mean, I hadn't seen my father in God knows how long. So, the name struck a bell. That was about it. I got a call from this woman who took him in under her wing, but he was becoming too much trouble. So she wanted to find out where he belonged. And so she called. I don't know how she found me. I really don't know how anyone found me. But that's how I found my father. We were in business at the time, my husband and myself. And I really didn't know what to do. We didn't want to diminish, you know, the fact that he was this big hero of the air. And so, you know, we bought him a suit and put him in our business and paid him, you know, although he did not absolutely nothing, but paid him so that he'd have some kind of self-respect. And so it went. Eventually, my husband and I got divorced. And then there was no longer an office and there was no longer a place for him to stay. And then he then moved to this friend originally that picked him up off the gutter. He moved back there and eventually died, I think. I really don't know. He was my father and he did go down in history as something. No matter how downhill his life went, he still is in the history books as first passenger to fly the Atlantic. And they can't take that away from him. And that's the story, as far as I know, about my father, Charles A. Levine.
Levine in sein